can't decide and torn between a romantic, comedy, action, or an indie film to watch for the weekend? Well, well, well. Golden State Media Concepts Movie Podcast is your ultimate guide to the latest movies. Join us as we dissect the latest on the blockbusters. It's the Golden State Media Concepts Movie Podcast.
Welcome to the GSMC Movie Podcast, brought to you by GSMC Podcast Network. I'm your host, Stacy, and today we are talking about two movies, Lou Over the Wall and The Women's Balcony. The first movie, Lou Over the Wall, is an animated feature out of Japan, which is about a mermaid who meets a young boy who happens to like music. I didn't know much going into this film, and I know I say that quite a bit. I had seen the poster at the movie theater, and it looked sort of Miyazaki-ish, even though I knew it was not a Miyazaki film. I think I may have mentioned on this podcast before, or on a different podcast, that I have not a problem, per se, with Miyazaki films, but that I don't enjoy them as much as other people, just because my sort of common sense of safety alarm keeps going off, and I'm just like, why are you all so super calm about things that would freak me out? Like in Ponyo, which is probably the closest to this film, there's a point where the two kids meet like a family after the island's been flooded, and the family is in one boat and the kids are in another, and the woman of the family knows the boy and like says hi, and then just lets the two kids go off on their own on this flooded island. And I'm just like, that's completely irresponsible. And fine, this is not actually your kid, but that's still probably like child endangerment. How do you just let these two kids who through the animation look four, but maybe are twice that, just go off by themselves on an island that's clearly flooded? What? Or like Totoro, and maybe it's because also I did not see Totoro until I was fully an adult, so I didn't have the like child awe of it. But when the two girls tell their father about Totoro, he like goes out and does a sort of ceremony of thanking him, and I'm just like, wait a minute, your two children just said they went off in the woods and met a giant beast, and your first thought is thank you? What? And maybe this is a cultural thing, because I do know, I'm not sure how much it's in Japan, but in parts of Asia where they're sort of believed to be not quite, sort of like spirits in different parts of nature that sort of look out or watch humans and possibly interact in their lives. And so maybe it has to do with that, of thinking when the girl said, oh, we met Totoro, thinking he's like a wood spirit or something. The Miyazaki films, most of them, since I saw them as an adult, my childhood sense of awe that he's trying to go with there just was somewhat gone at that point. So I was just like, that's not rational and whatever. But Lou Over the Wall, not Miyazaki, but I actually really quite liked this. It was, it's very cute. There's a moment in the film where the three main kids who are in a band together have to go before this sort of panel of adults, because Lou's been kind of exposed. She was dancing on a beach, and Lou has a thing where when the music plays, she can have legs, but when the music stops, she goes back to being a mermaid. And so the music was playing, and then it stopped, and then it was playing, and then it stopped. So a lot of people saw that this appeared to be a real mermaid. And the panel of adults wants to know where the mermaid is and how to get her to do this again, because that drew a lot of tourists to their really small town. And so they're hoping to sort of revitalize their town, which has a sort of fading fishing industry, by creating this tourist attraction with the real mermaid. And at one point, one of the adults on the panel is the girl in the band's grandfather. Well, actually, there's two adults on the panel. One is her father and one is her grandfather. Her father is very sort of uptight and businessy and only thinks about doing rational things. Her grandfather is more loose and freestyle. He's got a cowboy hat and he sort of speaks in the American dubbed version with the cowboy accent. I'm not sure what he sounds like in the Japanese, but presumably he still also has a cowboy hat in that one. But he at one point the grandfather is like, I normally thought, so the people of the town actually don't like mermaids because there's a whole legend about how terrible they are. So the grandfather's like, I always thought merfolk were like creepy and scary or whatever, but that was the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. And he practically like yells it. And it's just like, yeah, it really is. There are a number of moments where I had to like sort of refrain myself from going, oh, cause she really is very cute at times. Her ability to talk is somewhat limited, so she doesn't speak in proper grammar. It's not clear how old she is, because when she has legs, she sometimes can be taller and then sometimes looks like a very young child. But the way she talks is not in full grammar, so it's like, Lou, friend! Lou, everybody, friend! And it's just like, stop. I cannot deal with the adorableness. There's a moment where the two of the bandmates ask her if she wants to do her performance again, and she starts spinning around in the water while saying, Lou, everybody like, and I was just like, I need you to stop, move on to the next scene. I'm getting too caught in the cuteness here, and I also feel like the main character, Kai, that this is not going to go well, so I cannot be distracted by the cuteness right now. But she is just so adorable. The other characters, the three main kids are, I believe they're not yet in high school. It's actually kind of hard to tell most people's ages in this film. I thought the kids were in high school, but I don't know why. But then there's also Kai's father is in this film, and I thought that was his older brother for like so long until they actually specifically point out that, oh, hey, this is dad and dad had a band. I was like, well, what? That's your, oh, okay. All right. Going on. This film is taking sort of traditional mermaid things and not quite turning it on its head, but it's definitely not the way mermaids are traditionally thought of in this film. They're almost actually thought of kind of like vampires. They can't go in the sun for some reason, where they'll like burst into flames. And I'm just like, okay, this is vampires with fins. Continuing on. Oh, she's so cute. So it's a little strange. And Lou actually at one point has her father comes to town, the town that she's been spending a lot of time in because she's spending a lot of time with Kai. And while Lou looks sort of humanish, especially when she's got the legs, although her hair always seems to be somehow a floaty water bubble, her father is a giant shark in a suit with a hat and a pipe. And again, the problem I had with Miyazaki, no one really remarks on this. Like, all the people of this town kind of look at him and are like, but then treat him like a regular person. So at one point, they think he's supposed to be the person teaching them how to process fish, because again, this is a fishing town. And so they do what he says. And then later he's somehow been like made a board member of some company or something. And I'm just like, nobody's going to remark on the giant shark with the hat and pipe. What? You can tell he's a shark. Like, it's not hidden in the animation at all. That is a shark. But okay, animation's just, all the strange things in life are wonderful, I guess. Maybe I should just sort of try and live my life as if I wasn't, except no, because they can do accidents and falling things that would probably kill me easily much better than I can. But try and find my animation sense of childhood awe again that I've clearly lost. I'm not a Scrooge or a Grinch, I swear. It's just, I don't know, my more adulthood sense of common sense and safety is just like, wait a minute, just, but why? But no, you shouldn't do that. But I mean, maybe this town is just all more open, because at one point after her father's come to town, he's done something to the fish that they take to sell, so that later when one of the fish has been sold to this sort of sushi shop, the customer is remarking how fresh and plump this fish is, almost as if it just came out of the sea. And the sushi master, chef, is like, it's the processing. And then you see this fish skeleton sort of bust out of the fridge, or it's not clear. I thought it was a fridge, but I'm not sure why a fish skeleton would be in a fridge, but sort of busts out and walks on its hind fins out the door. And the customer is just like, and the chef's like, it's the processing. And I'm just like, wait a minute. None of you are going to talk about the walking fish skeleton? Does that happen, you know, semi-regularly? That it's just, it's the processing and that explains it? Okay, sure. Yeah, let's just go with it. Just continue to go with it. And hopefully you'll see more of cute Lou and her cute pets. And yeah, there's a number of people, because this film has... I mean, not the film. The village has this whole lore about the mermaids and how they're terrible and evil. They think of them as sirens in the way we generally think of sirens, you know, who sort of sing sailors to their death. It's sort of that sort of, I guess, legend about it. And there's a legend about the hill, the Shadow Hill, and that, like, supposedly once a mermaid was sort of sacrificed there, and so the town flooded, and so now we have to give homage or something to the Shadow Hill, and we filled in all the holes in the sort of shadow cliff wall for some reason. They have the sort of idea of, if there are mermaids, we heard they were dangerous, but we don't actually really believe they are mermaids until we see one. But that means that there are a couple of characters who are generally older, because it's always the crazy old people who actually know what they're talking about or whatever, who actually really do believe in mermaids and do believe they've seen them and hate them because the mermaids took people they love from them. There's a character that in the American dub version is titled Granny Octopus, who always walks around with like this long spear and just sort of spends every day looking out at the cove trying to find a sign of mermaids, because the mermaids took her love from her when she was real young. And the Granny Octopus character is kind of funny, because when you finally do really see her, she looks a lot like the character of Mulan's ancestor, the old woman, if you've ever seen the animated film. And it was hard for me to, like, when we finally see her and she talks about things, to sort of separate that in my head, because I was like, wait a minute, I like the old woman in Mulan, but I'm not supposed to like you. You're messing things up right now. I'm getting confused. What's going on? Likewise, the main character, Kai, his grandfather also hates the mermaids because he believes the mermaids took his mother away. So Kai's great-grandmother away as well. And so he hates the mermaids and doesn't want anything to do with them and knows that they're attracted to music. And so he always tells Kai not to, like, play music near the water, which Kai, of course, completely ignores. And that's how we sort of start the story, is Kai is in a house by the water, which is their, like, boathouse shed or something. And he goes there sort of to be alone. And Kai's interested in music but can't play an instrument. But he does do it on his computer. And he's playing it. And the mermaid, or at least Lou is actually attracted to the music. And being the sort of bright, everything's great character that she is, she has a way to sort of make water glow and float. And she does that and floats into the room where Kai is. And his response is interesting, because at first he's kind of freaked because, hey, giant floating wall of water with this mermaid coming at me. But then when she catches up to him, he just sort of stares at her at first and then starts talking to her. And she answers back, but he's worried about her voice, because it's high or something, and he doesn't want his grandfather to hear. So he puts his hand over her mouth, and I'm just like, dude, you don't know what that is? You don't know if that's going to kill you or eat you? Or, yeah, I, for all that, I am clearly not go with the really strange flow enough to survive in any sort of these anime films. I really did like this film. I thought it was very cute. There's a moment at the end with umbrellas that I won't talk about that nearly made me cry. And then the very ending is sort of, is that the end? Is there a sequel to this film? I'm not quite sure what that ending is telling me, saying, doing. I kind of really want more. But overall, for most of the film, I actually really liked it. And Lou possibly is the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. So we're going to take a short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the GSMC Movie Podcast.
Tired of searching the vast jungle of podcasts? Now listen close and hear this out. There's a podcast network that covers just about everything that you've been searching. The Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network is here. Nothing less than a podcast bliss with endless hours of podcast coverage. From news, sports, music, fashion, cooking, entertainment, fantasy, football, and so much more. So stop lurking around and go straight out to the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. Guaranteed to fill that podcast itch. Whatever it may be. Visit us at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And download us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play.
Welcome back. You're listening to the GSMC Movie Podcast. Our second film today is The Woman's Balcony, an Israeli film that deals with the members of a small synagogue, or at least I think it's small. It's only dealing with a certain number of members, whether or not the synagogue itself is small, dealing with some of the members and how they deal with the aftermath after the woman's balcony of their synagogue collapses during a ceremony. So if you're not Jewish, there's probably some things in this film that will go over your head. There's definitely some things that went over mine. I'm not sure. The women have their own separate area because, again, I'm not Jewish. There's also, and the sort of main thing that starts this film, even beyond the collapse of the balcony, is that the men of the synagogue want to get together and do a prayer or a Bible study. It kind of gets translated as both. And they need 10 men to do it for some reason. I'm not quite sure why. They need 10 men. I think they call it a quorum. And so they only have the four, the main four men that we generally deal with. And they kind of try asking other men in to pray with them. And they don't get any luck at first until they ask this young rabbi, Rabbi David, who agrees, but then sees they only have four. So he's like, wait a minute, and goes and brings back a bunch of people with him so that they have enough so that they can do the prayer. And then when they tell him, you know, this is why we were praying here and why we didn't have enough people, our synagogue collapsed, he goes to see it himself and he feels so moved that he wants to help them. But this is sort of one of those things where, like, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. He has the best intentions. He definitely kind of seems to mean well, at least at first, but because in the collapse, not only the balcony was destroyed, but their holy scroll was destroyed as well, he thinks the scroll is more important, but the women think the balcony is more important. And so there's a bit of a clash over which one will be done first, but he's a more conservative rabbi. And so it's not just that, oh, I think we need the scroll before we need a women's area, but it's also, why don't the women wear scarves and why don't they act in a more modest fashion? And so it starts being this thing of, that's not how we've ever done it. Why are you trying to change things? And why are you convincing our husbands to try to make us change? And our husbands, why are they going along with this? And then when some of the women start to go along with it, it's like, why don't you go along with it? Well, why should I have to go along with it? And so you start seeing this conflict about sort of the proper way to practice even their religion. There's a number of, there's at least two sort of different types of Jewish people, I guess, in this area. There's the members of this synagogue who seem a bit more open or relaxed about things. And then there are others who seem a bit more Orthodox. And there's a conflict between them because there's a little boy who belongs to the more Orthodox sect who likes to spend time with Zion, the sort of main guy of the more relaxed sect. But at some point, his mother comes by and says, you know, you're not allowed to be in there, the rabbi said. And it starts being this conflict between more conservative and more liberal ideas of what's allowed when you're Jewish. There's actually a quote at one point that everyone should take care of his own account with God, that this idea that I owe things to God and I'm supposed to follow certain things, but you also can't tell me what to do. So the main conflict, there's four couples here, four guys and their four wives, but the main one is Zion and Eddie. It was their, I believe, grandson's bar mitzvah when the balcony collapsed, and they're sort of the main I'm not quite sure what to call it. Zion is supposedly kind of in charge of the synagogue, but he's not the caretaker of the synagogue. There's a different person, but the original rabbi at one point chides him for not fixing a window in the synagogue like it's his responsibility. And then when that rabbi sort of becomes mentally ill, he is the one who repeatedly goes to his house to check on him, even though he's hired a caretaker to be there, but he still goes by to check on him. So he's sort of the most responsible, and Eddie's sort of the first lady, if you will, of the synagogue. But then when the new conservative rabbi comes in, some of the other women are convinced to sort of change their ways, and Eddie's not. And so at one point, it's really sort of Eddie versus everybody else. Even Eddie versus her husband, Zion, they have a fight over, I want to say it's Passover, over Passover dinner, where he asked her to be ready, and then something happened, so she wasn't ready on time. But then they finally do sit down to dinner, and the lights go out, which has happened before. And so Zion goes to get a Sabbath Gentile. I'm not quite sure what that is. I do believe there is something about Jewish people are not supposed to sort of touch flip switches or something. That comes up early in the film, too, is there's a little boy who's playing with the switches on like a large tea kettle or something. And when he gets caught, he's just switched it off. And the woman who chides him is like, you want to hit it one more time just because? And he says no. So she's like, okay, go to your mother, and then hits it herself. And then she's later one of the people who becomes most conservative after the new rabbi comes in. So it's sort of like knowing you've... I guess she feels a bit reticent over past sins she's done. And so she kind of goes too far in the other way. But Eddie starts to feel that everyone's against her because the woman who used to be totally like her are now like, oh, we have to cover our hair and we can't come to your fundraiser because it goes against what the new rabbi says. And then her husband's also very taken with the new rabbi. So when they have this argument over whether or not they can use a Sabbath Gentile to turn on the lights, the conservative rabbi says, you can't use a Sabbath Gentile, that ruins the holiday. And she says, well, we can't eat in the dark, that ruins the holiday. And he kind of ends up winning. And so she really at one point feels like there's nobody on my side. And you do see that a couple of times. And you see it a bit later, too, with different members of the synagogue and the rabbi himself, of this idea of sort of having the courage of your convictions and standing behind what it is you believe, even if others don't stand with you. The rabbi, David, this new rabbi, he at first kind of does seem pretty good. He oversees their rebuilding of the synagogue, but doesn't make it with the balcony, just has it rebuilt, period, because evidently there needs to be a rabbi for it. And he's the like teacher at a seminary. And I apologize if that's not the correct term for what this Jewish school place would be called. But then he later, as the movie goes on, starts to seem a bit, not evil, kind of a bit misogynistic. He goes on a rant, and this is what sort of starts the first argument between the men and their wives about women and the way women are described in the Holy Book, and how a woman is somehow considered the equal of the Torah, even though she never studies it, but men have to study to get to that level. And so if she's supposedly that high, shouldn't she be modest and cover her hair? And so he convinces the men to take headscarves home to their wives to be modest. And the women, who aren't used to this, are just like, no. Except for Eddie, who's like, oh, it's beautiful. Thank you. I'll wear it on Passover. So she at least kind of meets him halfway, even though none of the women know that this is kind of a test. But then when they, I mean, not Passover, the ceremony to open the synagogue, I apologize. But then when they go to open the synagogue and see there's not a women's balcony, Eddie leaves because she's angry, and the rest of the women stay and listen to the new rabbi. And so they're kind of almost hypnotized by them. That's almost the way they describe it later when they're telling Eddie. It's like, it's a shame you left. I don't agree with what he said, but at the same time, I kind of felt like I couldn't move while he was talking. There's also a kind of cute side story with Eddie's niece. And I'm not sure she's actually her niece, but she does call Eddie and Zion uncle and aunt. So I'm not sure if that's, I know in some cultures that's just the title you say for someone you're close to and respectful with, but they might actually be her aunt and uncle. They're very close to her, and she lives, I believe, below them. But she is a single young woman, and you do see her at one point go on a date that she's been set up on, but she doesn't like it. But then she later meets this young man who is learning under the new rabbi, and they kind of hit it off. But because we're now in this sort of cold war between Rabbi David and the women, they don't tell anybody about it because they don't want one side or the other to get on them about it. They just sort of want to see how it goes while they can. But that's kind of hinted at when we first meet each of them, because there's this cute thing where they both have clothing tags on their clothes, but they didn't notice. And so Eddie takes the one off of the girl, Yaffa, and Zion, when he meets the boy, when the rabbis come by his store, takes it off him. And I totally didn't catch that till later. I was just like, oh yeah, the clothing tag people got together. All right. But yeah, so you see this fight, and Yaffa is, she supports Eddie. I'm not sure how much she agrees with her, but she supports Eddie, and the women get together and raise the money for their balcony, since the whole reason the balcony wasn't built when the synagogue was repaired was because they supposedly didn't have enough money. So they get together themselves and raise the money and hand it to one of the women's husband, who is the custodian, caretaker, treasurer, whatever, to put in the synagogue's sort of bank account, and then he's supposed to give it to them back. But a lot of the checks are postdated, so he, I guess, can't give it to them right away. But then he lets slip to Rabbi David that this is what's happened, and the rabbi's like, no, we have to have a scroll first. The women will understand later. They'll feel happy about it later. They'll be upset now, but they'll see later that it was really better to have a scroll first. But then it turns out we're going to pay for the scroll with the money the woman raised for their balcony. And so this now starts to become a war, even with the woman who did sort of turn more conservative after Rabbi David came. It sort of becomes a cold war between the women and their husbands. And then the women decide, you know what, if the rabbi is going to try and ruin our lives this way, well, let's go kind of make some trouble for him. And they start protesting outside of the, again, I apologize, I don't know what the name is, the school where he works. And then this is where he starts to really seem like a terrible person. He tells one of the people there to, like, call the lawyer to tell them to write up letters against each of the women. And when the person asks for what, he's like, libel, slander, whatever will make them go away. And it's just like, you seem kind of, that's kind of dirty politician to just make up things against people because they're bothering you. Okay. And then he tells Yaffa's the clothing tag boy, who is one of his students, to take the check out immediately so they can get the scroll. And so he's really not even going through proper channels because he feels he's so right about what is proper, what it says in the Holy Word about which one's more important and which one comes first. And the women are like, we have our rights too. It's not exactly on a gender thing. It is almost more conservative versus liberal. And it just happens to be about the women's balcony, because there's not too much else that comes up gender-wise beyond the women should have a place to worship as well. But is that more important than having the Holy Scroll and the whole thing of women keeping their head covered to be modest? There's nothing else really involved with gender issues there. It starts becoming a bit more marital strife at times, if anything else. But it was a nice film. It was, I won't say sweet, but I felt sort of warm-hearted at the end. I liked the women, at least the main characters. Marguerite especially is a strong-willed character who even herself at times can fall prey to, not fall prey, I don't mean fall prey, fall under the spell of the rabbi and sort of consider more what he thinks than exactly what she feels herself. But especially the idea of sticking with your convictions, even if you're sticking by yourself, I think was really well played out in this film. So yeah, it is available out now on DVD, and it is Israeli, so you would have to watch it with subtitles. But yes, so we're going to end for today. Thank you for listening to the GSMC Movie Podcast. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Golden State Media Concepts Movie Podcast, part of the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. You can find this show and others like it at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Just type in GSMC to find all the shows from the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network, from movies to music, from sports to entertainment, and even weird news. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed today's program.